Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 189. Thank you guys for tuning in. Just wanted to remind people that are listening to this podcast through the audio format from SoundCloud. This will probably be the last, or no, won't probably. This will be the last podcast that you'll be able to get on SoundCloud. So if you want to find this podcast, you can do so by doing a search for According to Sam on any of your other audio platforms, and you should be able to find the podcast. You'll definitely be able to find the video format on YouTube, on Rumble, on X. It's on Substack as well. So you should be able to find on Spotify is another audio format, Apple Podcasts. It's on all those formats. So thank you guys for tuning in. And we're in week two now of the standoff to get Ukraine funding. And as I've been telling you in the past few weeks, Ukraine funding is the priority of the Uniparty. The funding Ukraine and continuing the war in Ukraine is a priority for the Uniparty, and the longer that this standoff lasts, the House of Representatives, they're on a two-week recess now, and they won't be back for another week, so it's going to at least last another week. I told you about the parliamentary procedure that they have floated to force the bill to the floor. But the longer this standoff lasts, you're going to start seeing more and more pressure being put on the Speaker of the House and the Republicans in the House of Representatives to get this thing passed, because Ukraine is in a time crunch. Every day matters is what they're telling us, that they're running out of ammunition. For me, I don't support the war. I think that they should negotiate peace. They should have negotiated peace a long time ago. As a matter of fact, they did negotiate peace. They negotiated the Minsk agreement. You had Minsk 1 and Minsk 2, which the French and Germans, they are the ones who facilitated this negotiation. And Ukraine agreed to terms, and Russia agreed to terms in Minsk 1. And then they came back and they renegotiated in Minsk 2. And Angela Merkel, the leader of Germany at that time, she came out and said that all of this negotiating in Minsk was just a ploy, that Ukraine never meant to keep up the agreements that they made in Minsk. And it was all a ploy to arm the Ukrainians, to train the Ukrainians, to get the Ukrainians equipped for a war is what they wanted. So they wanted the war. And you're going to see there's going to be more evidence that I'm going to show you of that here in this podcast. But now the game is it's a game of chicken, I guess. And we'll see what happens when the House is back in session. But people aren't being honest with you. People aren't. You have Joe Biden right now saying that Speaker Johnson is threatening our allies, and the House Republicans are in chaos because they're allowing Putin to win. They are sympathizing with Putin. Well, what they're not telling you, and the media, who is also doing the work of the Biden administration by defaming the Speaker of the House, they're not explaining to you that Speaker Johnson, before they went on recess a week ago, you see the date here on this article, February 14th. This is Valentine's Day. This is, I think, the day before they called the recess. Speaker Johnson, he said that he wanted to meet with Joe Biden. White House rejects Johnson's request to meet with Biden. What is there to negotiate is what Biden says. I'm not going to meet with you. What is there to negotiate that, you know, I don't have time to meet with you is what Biden basically said. Johnson says that he wants to talk with Biden on the border security and foreign aid. Biden told him to pound sand. So he called recess and they went on vacation. And now they're on vacation, and every day that goes by, Biden is like saying that the speaker's being irresponsible. The speaker is to blame because, he won't pass this bill. They're on vacation, Biden. You said you didn't want to meet with them. He said, what is there to negotiate? Now, it's funny because people think that just because the Senate passed this thing, that the House automatically has to pass it. And nothing can be further from the truth. The House doesn't have to pass this at all. As a matter of fact, the Republicans won the House of Representatives last year with a mandate to be a hindrance to Joe Biden's policy, not to just wave through Joe Biden's policy. And a lot of Republican voters who went to the polls last November, the biggest mandate was to stop the spending, to rein in the spending, to get control of the budget, and to get control of the debt. That was the number one mandate, and that entailed stopping the Democrats and Joe Biden from, just passing another $1 trillion Inflation Reduction Act, another stimulus here, whatever they wanted. So that was the mandate, was to stop the spending. But stopping the foreign aid, which is part of the spending as well. A lot of people don't know that this is supplemental spending. I heard someone saying the other day that foreign aid is only 1% of our budget. Yeah, that's the budget. This is supplemental aid of another supplemental funds of $60 billion. It's not included in the budget, if you don't know that. So the House of Representatives has a mandate. They don't have to pass this bill just because the Senate passed it. And everyone's saying that the Senate passed it bipartisan. It was bipartisan, overwhelming in the Senate. Less than half of the Republican caucus, less than half of the Republican caucus in the Senate voted for this. So you got the entire Democrat caucus, besides two people voted against it in the Democrat caucus. And then you had less than half of the Republican caucus join the Democrats to pass this. So there's some, a bipartisan mandate on the House of Representatives that they have to pass this? No. But why wouldn't Biden? I mean, this is on Biden, people. Why would Biden reject a meeting with the Speaker of the House? Biden knows how this works. And he rejects the meeting, and then they call the recess. Now they're on recess, and then Biden is using these 2 weeks that they're on recess to defame the speaker and act like, he's not willing to work when he's obviously willing to work with Biden. He wanted to meet with him, and they told him no. So let's get back into talking about, in the last podcast, we were talking about Russiagate, how they're bringing Russiagate back. And there were two questions that we were looking at, because we asked the question, what happened between 2009 when the Barack Hussein Obama administration did the Russian reset and reset our relationship with Russia, that this is no longer Cold War Russia anymore, that this is a new Russia, and we reset our relationship. And then Obama in 2012, in the debate with Mitt Romney, The 1980s called and the 1980s won their foreign policy back. So we were asking the question, what happened between that time and that reset relationship with Russia to tarnish our relationship with Russia again? How did Russia and Vladimir Putin become the big boogeyman? I identified three issues, and the three issues were what happened in Syria, that Russia backed Assad and ratted out Obama to the United Nations and was fighting the ISIS terrorists who Obama was supporting, and Syria and Iraq. That is what started to sour the relationship. And then we identified the meddling in the 2016 election, Russiagate point one. And then we said that the invasion of Crimea, those three things were the three major things that separated the relationship from the reset that Obama did in 2009. So we were looking at the meddling in the 2016 election in the last podcast, and I explained and showed how they lied and said that the assessment, and all it was an assessment. There's no hard evidence in the assessment. The assessment gets low, moderate, or high confidence. And the assessment of high confidence came from the John Brennan CIA and the James Comey FBI, and the NSA gave it moderate confidence. But I explained how this assessment has no evidence in it, and they sold it as an assessment from all 17 intelligence agencies, and it was only two intelligence agencies, the two intelligence agencies that have the least amount of credibility with the American people. And I told you they were running Russiagate 2.0 back. You got to hear some of this unhinged propaganda that they are spreading, these people. This is Eric Swalwell, and he's a congressman out of Northern California. Listen to this. This is completely unhinged. No one with a brain would believe this Orwellian propaganda that this guy is spewing. Listen to this.
I don't know if you saw it or not, but Donald Trump is at it again. This guy loves Russia. And he just said recently that basically Vladimir Putin should invade any NATO country that's not doing what Donald Trump thinks they need to be doing.
That's not what he said, first of all. And listen to the music. The music's hilarious that he said that Putin can invade any country that he wanted to. Listen to this.
Vladimir Putin should invade any NATO country that's not doing what Donald Trump thinks they need to be doing.
If we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us? Let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want.
Listen to this edit. Check out this edit. There's like three edits there. He doesn't even play what Donald Trump actually said. He just cuts these little edits together happen. To make it.
No, I would not protect you.
Vladimir Putin should invade any NATO country that's not doing what Donald Trump thinks they need to be doing.
If we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us? Let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want.
He's inviting an attack on our greatest allies. So why the hell should you care about what's happening over in Russia? Well, for starters, Putin has a desire to not just take over Ukraine, but put back together the Soviet Union.
Putin has a desire to put back together the Soviet Union? Where does this come from?
For starters, Putin has a desire to not just take over Ukraine, but put back together the Soviet Union and threaten and invade dozens of our allies over in the region. This fight is coming to us. Ukraine's fight is our fight for freedom. And it's a lot cheaper for us to help Ukraine now than for us to have to wage that fight later.
So this sounds like George Bush. They hate us because of our freedom. And in the early 2000s, you remember that? They hate us because of our freedom, that we're going to be more free, that we need to back Ukraine so we can be more free over here. What are you talking about?
And threaten and invade dozens of our allies over in the region. This fight is coming to us. Ukraine's fight is our fight for freedom. And it's a lot cheaper for us to help you.
Ukraine's fight is our fight for freedom. Wow.
This fight is coming to us. Ukraine's fight is our fight for freedom. And it's a lot cheaper for us to help Ukraine now than for us to have to wage that fight later. But what can we do? Well, we're not helpless. We first have to fund Ukraine. But this coming November, we have to beat Donald Trump and MAGAism. Because Donald Trump needs Putin, and Putin needs Donald Trump. And if we beat Trump, I promise you, we'll have more freedom, not just here in America, but we'll make sure that Ukraine can reclaim and renew their own democracy. And
if we beat Trump, I promise you, we'll have more freedom here in America. That's what he says.
Trump and MAGAism. Because Donald Trump needs Putin, and Putin needs Donald Trump. And if we beat Trump, I promise you, we'll have more freedom, not just here in America, but we'll make sure that Ukraine can reclaim and renew their own democracy, and that freedom will win worldwide.
Wow, man, that is so, so deranged. And then listen to this guy. So let me tell you a little bit about this guy who you're looking at on the screen there if you're watching the podcast. This guy's name is Andrew Weissman. Now, when we're talking about the Mueller investigation in the last podcast, and I was explaining how there is a 2-year-long special counsel investigation. 2 years that a special counsel from the United States Justice Department was looking at. And we're going to look at what they were looking at exactly in this investigation here in a moment, but there was a 2-year-long special counsel investigation, and Robert Mueller was the special counsel, but Robert Mueller had a team of lawyers under him, several lawyers. This guy right here, Andrew Weissman, he was running the team, basically. He was Robert Mueller's deputy number two. And then if you remember when Robert Mueller testified to Congress, Robert Mueller wasn't very coherent at all. I mean, he looked kind of like Joe Biden does any given day. So it makes me wonder how much of the investigation Robert Mueller was running at all. So this guy was pretty much running the entire Mueller investigation for 2 years, Andrew Weissman. And I told you that they're running Russiagate back. I want you to listen. This is astonishing what you're getting ready to hear with this guy who ran the Mueller investigation again for 2 years, Russiagate 1. And now they're running Russiagate 2.0 back. And I want you to listen to what this guy says.
I just want to make sure people understand something that Frank said, which is, The former president's really good at trying to just by using this phrase Russia, Russia, Russia to sort of be like, oh, that's behind us and nothing was there. And so move on. That's just some Democratic ploy.
So that's behind us and nothing was there. You looked at it for 2 years. You investigated it for 2 years. There, nothing was there, bro. What are you talking about?
The president's really good at trying to just by using this phrase Russia, Russia, Russia to sort of be like, oh, that's behind us and nothing was there. And so move on. That's just some Democratic ploy. When, as Professor Snyder at Yale has said, that is like a tactic to not have us look at what are the actual facts. That was that investigation in 2016 was about whether there was a
investigation in 2016 led to your special counsel appointment in 2017, which lasted until 2019, buddy. Okay, so let's just be clear that he's talking about Russiagate 1, Crossfire Hurricane, which Crossfire Hurricane led to the appointment of Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation, which lasted 2 years, which this guy ran. That's what he's talking about.
That investigation in 2016 was about whether there was a criminal proof beyond a reasonable doubt of a criminal conspiracy between the Trump campaign up to and including Trump and the Russian government. That is a very different thing than what we're talking about, which is was Russia then and now trying to interfere in the election? There is no question it was doing that then, and there is no question it is doing it now, and there's no question it is going to continue doing that.
I got plenty of questions, Weissman.
That is a given, and as you pointed out, not only does Putin need it, because if Donald Trump wins, Ukraine is over. Let's just call it what it is.
Correct.
And Trump needs it because if he wins, the federal cases are over and the state cases are on ice. So the confluence of interests couldn't be stronger.
So like a good lawyer there, he's setting up motive, saying that the motive is there, that Russia's got the motive to meddle in the elections in 2024 because if Trump wins, then Ukraine is over. So that's good for Russia. And Trump's got the motives to accept the help from Russia this time, even though we had a 2-year-long special counsel investigation and found no connection to Russia and Donald Trump. I want you to look here at the... This is the letter that appointed Robert Mueller as the special counsel from the Office of Deputy Attorney General. And if you remember, the reason the Deputy Attorney General appointed the special counsel is because the Attorney General had recused himself, Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions recused himself from all matters having to do with this because they were spying on Jeff Sessions and learned that he, in his capacity as a senator, he met with Russian diplomats. I don't know why he recused himself over that, but he did. And Rod Rosenstein became the deputy attorney general. And this is the letter appointing Robert Mueller. And right here, I hereby as ordered follows Robert Mueller III is appointed to serve as special counsel for United States Department of Justice. The special counsel is authorized to conduct the investigation confirmed by the FBI and James Comey in testimony before the House Select Committee on Intelligence. So basically, they're picking up Robert Mueller's basically picking up the investigation from James Comey and the FBI, the Crossfire Hurricane investigation led right into the appointment of this special counsel, which Weissman here, he ran the whole show. Okay. He ran it. He's saying that, now he's saying that investigation was only looking at, beyond a reasonable doubt, a connection with Russia and Donald Trump, which we looked at for 2 years and we found nothing. And Crossfire Hurricane, who looked at it before we got the case, found nothing. No connection beyond a reasonable doubt after a 2-year-long investigation. But this is what the letter that Rod Rosenstein, this is the latitude that the acting attorney general gave Robert Mueller and Andrew Weissman in their investigation. It says that the investigation is supposed to look at any links or coordination between Russia, the Russian government, and individuals associated with the campaign of President Donald Trump, and any matters that arose or may arise, or any matters that arose or may arise, or any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation and any other matters in the scope of Section 28 CFR 600.4. If the special counsel believes it is necessary and appropriate, the special counsel is authorized to prosecute federal crimes. To prosecute federal crimes. Donald Trump was not prosecuted for any federal crimes. that related to the links or coordination between he, his campaign, Russia. I mean, y'all found nothing, Weissman. And now you're running Russiagate 2? You should be embarrassed. This is what it's about. This is what it's all about. This article came out today, and it's a very interesting article. It says that the prospect of a second Trump presidency has intelligence community on edge. On edge. Now, why would the intelligence community care who's going to be the next president of the United States? And the intelligence community, why would they have any say-so about who's going to be the next president of the United States? This is what we're talking about when we talk about the deep state people. We're talking about the security spy state, the intelligence community. It says here, former top officials from Donald Trump's administration are warning that he likely could use a second term to overhaul the nation's spy agencies in a way that could lead to unprecedented levels of politicization of intelligence. Well, you got to understand that the intelligence community has already taken a very significant overhaul after 9/11. There was no director of national intelligence before 9/11. And all of the intelligence agencies, even the FBI used to be a police force, not an intelligence agency. But after 9/11, George Bush put the FBI under the Director of National Intelligence, and now it's an intelligence agency. And so a lot of these changes in the intelligence community have only been in place for the last two decades. So and it hasn't been working out very well for the American people, this new intelligence community. So I'm all for Donald Trump coming in and making some changes, especially in the light of what I'm going to tell you guys today and what I've already been telling you about these rogue deep state intelligence agencies, particularly the CIA and the FBI. So the intelligence community is they're on edge because Donald Trump is, I mean, he's running very strong right now, very strong. And there's a chance that he can be elected. And is it going to be one of these deals like in 2016 where the FBI and the CIA actively worked to undermine him? Is that going to be the case? And do we want to live in a country where unelected officials in the security spy state are working to undermine the, is that a democracy? Is that a democracy? You remember what Chuck Schumer says? We played it in the last podcast, but let's listen to him again.
Let me ask you, I don't know if you have, he's taking these shots, this antagonism, yep, this taunting to the intelligence community.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. So even for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, he's being really dumb to do this.
Six ways to Sunday. You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways of Sunday at getting back at you. So that brings us to this article. This article came out. You can look at the date here, February 25th, just 2 days ago. This article was written in the New York Times. This is not the New York Times. I don't pay for the New York Times, so I couldn't bring the New York Times, actual New York Times article up, but this is a syndication of the New York Times article. And in the headline, the spy war, how the CIA secretly helps Ukraine fight Putin. And this article is absolutely everything that I've been saying. Hold on one moment. Everything that I've been telling you guys about Ukraine, about the coup, about Euromaidan, about the CIA's involvement. It is all in this article. The CIA maintains, this is Yahoo News, and basically they this article is breaking down the New York Times article. CIA maintains 12 secret bases in Ukraine. CIA head was in Kiev last week. New York Times. Just 2 days ago, this came out. Very explosive article. Details. New York Times report that before full-scale war, the Ukrainians proved themselves to the Americans by collecting intercepted data that helped prove Russian involvement in the downing of the Malaysian airline jetliner in Malaysian Airlines jetliner in 2014. Ukrainians also helped Americans prosecute the Russian agents who interfered in the 2016 election. And Ukraine was involved. That's why when the phone call that Donald Trump had with Zelensky that they impeached him for, most of the conversation, Donald Trump was talking about the servers, the DNC servers that they said Russia hacked. The FBI did no forensic investigation of these servers. The only forensic investigation of these servers was done by CrowdStrike, a company that the DNC hired, that they contracted, which they came out of Ukraine. Well, one of the founders of CrowdStrike is a Russian who went to Ukraine. So Donald Trump, in that phone call, most of the conversation in the beginning of the conversation, when Donald Trump says, can you do me a favor? He's talking about to Zelensky about helping him find those servers. So this first paragraph is pretty much nonsense. But check out this second paragraph. Around 2016. Now, that's when the 2016 election is going on. This is President Barack Obama's last year in office. President Obama's president, not Trump. The head of the CIA is John Brennan. This is Obama's CIA. Around 2016, the CIA began training an elite Ukrainian Special Forces unit known as Unit 2245, which captured Russian drones and communications equipment so that the CIA technicians could reverse engineer them and crack Moscow's encryption system. According to the New York Times, one of the officers in this unit was the current head of defense of intelligence, Kirilo Badeno. So I want you to listen to a little bit of Jack Posowiec, and he breaks down this article from the New York Times that just came out 2 days ago. It's absolutely explosive.
Ladies and gentlemen, according to no illustrious less of a source than the New York Times, a stunning bombshell was just released today where 12, count them, 12 secret spy bases were built in Ukraine before the war. Excuse me? I was told that the war was completely unprovoked. I was told that the war happened for no reason whatsoever. Now, all of a sudden, the New York Times, of all places, puts out an article stating that there were 12 secret spy bases in Ukraine and waged a shadow war against Russia for the last decade. This is an incredibly extensive article. We're going to go through a lot of it in detail. But it shows how CIA units were embedding with and training Ukrainian intelligence, Ukrainian special forces, and direct involvement with the Ukrainian government, including, by the way, 10 years. And this week is the 10-year anniversary of the Maidan coup, a coup.
Absolutely. So we'll stop there because what he's saying is absolutely right. 10 years ago, the Maidan coup happened, and I was explaining to you last Monday about how the coup started with the snipers that somebody that you had the two different factions. You had the protesters that George Soros and civil society had called out to Maidan to protest Yanukovych and the trade deal that he was making with Russia. And they came out and they wanted to force Yanukovych to accept the trade deal with the EU. They wanted closer ties with the EU. And then you had the Yanukovych government that were standing off against these people. These people also were comprised of a small minority of Nazis, neo-fascists, and that someone on February 20th, so last Monday when I gave my did my podcast talking about the sniper and how, you know, the we played the clip of the Estonian foreign minister saying that all the intelligence shows that the snipers were shooting at both sides, that there was a sniper shooting at the police and snipers shooting at the protesters. And then we played the clip of the BBC interviewing the guy who wouldn't show his face, saying, yeah, I was there. I was sniping at the protesters and at the police. And then once the violence started, then that is what kicked off Euromaidan 10 years ago. And I was explaining how Putin says that that was all the work of the CIA. And the CIA, not the CIA was there pulling the trigger, but the CIA went out and found the shooters, just like the Kennedy assassination. I was saying the CIA was there pulling the trigger, but the CIA went out and found the shooters. The CIA set the whole thing up. And now we learn that the CIA has been there this whole time, and it's coming out in the New York Times. Why is the New York Times coming out with a story like this right now? This is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. We learned that they were there the entire time. And that they had bases there. So, and they had communications with Ukrainians and that they were already working with. So it's very well that Putin could be right that the CIA are the ones who staged the coup. Because like I told you last Monday, whoever started the shooting, whoever got the shooting started, they're the ones who started this war. The current war that's going on right now, whoever got the shooting started on February 20th, 2014, that's the person, or those persons are the ones who started the war that is going on right now. Once you take a look at this clip, this is John Brennan. If you don't know who he is, he was the head of the CIA. He's a Jesuit. Just want to put that out there that he is a Jesuit. He was the head of the CIA during the Obama administration. He was the one running the operations in Ukraine, but not only in Ukraine. This is a very wicked man. This man right here is a very wicked man. Take a look at this.
Various people have said that John Brennan, the head of the CIA, traveled possibly under another name to Kyiv. And I just wanted to know, did he travel there? Does it have anything to do with this action? Just to
no, it happened only in some commands from Moscow. I don't know. So,
thank you.
Were you in Kyiv recently?
I was in Kyiv a couple weeks ago, yes.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us what your mission was?
I was out there to interact with our Ukrainian partners and friends.
Ukraine's acting president has announced the start of an anti-terrorist operation in the east of the country.
Today was the day Kyiv sent in troops to try to wrest back control of the east.
Troops traveling west. I don't want to get ahead of myself there, but yes, John Brennan was there. He was there during the coup himself. He flew over there. He was running it. They were running it. They were running it with George Soros and civil society. The civil society and the George Soros NGO were doing the things that the government couldn't do there on the ground, because George Soros had a presence there on the ground. But what the Obama administration could do was dump a bunch of money into George Soros's NGO. So back to the question. We were going to ask the question today, did Russia invade Crimea? Because that's one of the major things that they tell us that Russia did. Why the relationship with Russia soured and went from the reset relationship that Obama did in 2009 to now Russia's the big boogeyman. And they tell us that, well, one of the major reasons is that in 2014, Russia invaded Crimea. And I told you that Russia has had this naval base in Sevastopol since the late 18th century, since Catherine the Great. The Russians have had this naval base on this peninsula. So in 2014, they had this naval base. Since the naval base has been there since the late 18th century, that means that the naval base was there in 2014. And I asked the question, how do you invade a territory where you have a military base? And that would be like I guess if the United States came out of their military base in Germany and took over Germany, because we have military bases there in Germany, I guess that would count as us invading Germany, but that's not what happened in Crimea. So we were talking about because I was explaining to you, well, let's go back here and then I'll get to that. So we were talking about just a moment ago about the sniping and how the snipers, whoever the snipers were, if they were CIA or whoever they were, the snipers started shooting at both factions there in Maidan. They got the shooting started. And then once the snipers got the shooting started, both sides were well armed and started shooting back and forth at each other. The Ukrainian police and the Nazis and the protesters were well armed as well. So they started shooting back at each other. Tons of people got killed. And then that kicked off all of the other major violence that took place in Euromaidan, which led to the coup, which led to Yanukovych and his government having to flee. And then the Nazi government that we backed took control of the country. All of that started with the snipers. And that happened on February 20th. That's the date that that happened. Last Monday, when I did my podcast and I was explaining all the sniping and everything and how that went down, that was February 19th. And it was ironic. It's not like I planned to do that podcast on that day, but the podcast that I did last Monday explaining how the snipers set off Euromaidan, it was on the day before the 10-year anniversary of this event. The next morning was the 10-year anniversary. Serendipitous. Because after I posted the podcast last Monday, it's funny, I went to X and you have Queen Ursula here. And if you don't know, Queen Ursula is the head of the EU. And you can see her tweet and you can see the date here. She had posted it that night that I posted my podcast on February 20th. So this is February 19th. So this isn't the actual anniversary, but she wanted to get ahead of it. So this is 11 p.m. in the evening. She's posting this post to commemorate the anniversary, which is tomorrow, February 20th. The anniversary of what? Of what, Queen Ursula? Today we pay tribute to the Heavenly Hundred Heroes, the brave souls, and that's what they called the people who got killed in Maidan that day, the Heavenly Hundred. The Heavenly Hundred heroes, the brave souls who sacrificed their lives on the Maidan for Ukraine's freedom in 2014. A decade on, their vision and ideals have triumphed. Ukraine will prevail and take its place in our union. Let's look at this propaganda video that she put out. On the anniversary of the start of the war, and I'm going to show you, she doesn't say that in her tweet, but we're going to look at another one here in a moment. This is an anniversary that she is commemorating that 10 years ago, this happened 10 years ago, is when this war has been going on for 10 years. So because something really funny happened this last week. I think it was on Saturday, the 24th is the anniversary, the 2-year anniversary of when Russia rolled in and invaded. So that was the 2-year anniversary. So you have these two different anniversaries coming within the same week. The 10-year anniversary is the anniversary of the snipers getting the shooting started and the violence happening at Maidan. But Saturday was the 2-year anniversary of Russia rolling in. So this tweet from Queen Ursula and this video is to commemorate the 10-year anniversary when the war started. Take a listen.
The anniversary that we mark today is a tragic loss of human lives and suffering. Maidan protests where people were shot because they wrapped themselves into a European flag.
No, that's not why they were shot. They weren't shot because they wrapped themselves in a European flag, Queen Ursula. They were shot because someone, we don't know who, started shooting at both sides and got the shooting started, and that's why they were killed. Not because they wrapped themselves
into a European flag. Into a European flag. The future of Ukraine is in the European Union. The future that the Maidan fought for has finally just begun. And this will be your ultimate victory. A free and prosperous and vibrant Ukraine. A sovereign Ukraine that is finally reunited with our European family. Slava Ukraini.
So, so they tell us that, people, which is it? Did the war start 2 years ago when Russia rolled into Ukraine, or did the war start 10 years ago? And obviously, according to Queen Ursula here, the war started 10 years ago in 2014 with Maidan, with the snipers. That's when it started. It didn't start 2 years ago when Russia rolled in. And then here is Zelensky. This is the current president of Ukraine, and his tweet comes the next morning. This is February 20th. This is 5 a.m. in the morning, February 20th, on the anniversary of the start of the war 10 years ago. And the president of Ukraine here, Volodymyr Zelensky, 10 years ago, the Ukrainians made their choice, a choice of independence, democracy, and unity with the world. This choice remains unchanged. Together, in unity, we will protect our country and people. And let's look at his propaganda film or clip here.
10 years ago, Ukrainians rebelled against a pro-Russian government that wanted to limit people's freedom and separate Ukraine from Europe. Back then, Ukrainians already knew who the real enemy was and why it was crucial to choose the European Union and unity with the whole world. People fought for freedom under the EU flag for the first time. Though special forces tried to brutally disperse the protesters. However, the people withstood Ukrainians showed their extraordinary courage even then. It grew to the revolution of dignity. The protests lasted from November to February. People did not leave the Maidan in Kyiv. They also stayed in squares and streets of other cities and kept fighting. Special forces shot unarmed protesters in squares and streets of other
cities. The protests went from November to February. I think I had said that they started in early December. I think the first protesters did go out in November. So from November to February is when they started.
From November to February. People did not leave the Maidan in Kyiv. They also stayed in squares and streets of other cities and kept fighting. Special forces shot unarmed protesters and attacked them with stun grenades and tear gas. A lot of those who resisted were kidnapped, tortured, and even killed. More than 100 of people died during the Revolution of Dignity. We call them the Heavenly Hundred. On February 20th, we honor the memory of people who lost their lives for Ukraine's independence during the Revolution of Dignity.
February 20th, 10 years ago. 10 years ago. Here's another one. 10 years ago, peaceful protesters took to Maidan. No. What is this guy talking about? 10 years ago, peaceful protesters took to Maidan. They took to Maidan in November. They didn't take to Maidan 10 years ago. You're referring to the violence starting because someone John Brennan hired started shooting at people, and that's how the war started 10 years ago. 10 years ago. I want you to listen to the ambassador to the United States from Ukraine make reference to 10 years ago this started.
So Ambassador, what is your message to House Republicans right now who are holding up more than $60 billion in new U.S. military aid to your country? Do you blame them for these setbacks in Ukraine that we're seeing?
Well, there is only one here to blame. It's Putin and Russians who started this aggressive war 10 years ago, exactly today, and who restarted it 2 years ago.
10 years ago, they started it, and then they restarted it 2 years ago. So what was happening between that time? What was happening in Donbass during that time? Since they started it 2 years ago, 10 years ago, and then they restarted it 2 years ago. So there was nothing happening between that time? What are these people doing? Who do these people think you are? Who do they think you are, people? Listen to what she says. That the Russians started it 10 years ago and then restarted it 2 years ago.
There is only one here to blame. It's Putin and Russians who started this aggressive war 10 years ago, exactly today, and who restarted it 2 years ago. And my message...
They restarted it 2 years ago. So, oh my God. That's a lot of time in between with no war going on. But there was war going on, people. A lot of war going on through all of those 10 years. And those wars were going on. And the people who were suffering in those wars... or the people that I've been trying to explain to you did not go along with the coup d'etat. And I was telling you, I've been telling you, if you've been watching the podcast for the past few weeks, that while this coup is going on in Kyiv, like I've been telling you, this coup being staged by the Obama administration, by the CIA, by George Soros and civil society. This is taking place in the capital of the country here in Kyiv. And like I was explaining last Monday, you want to think about this like January 6th. Remember, all of the Trump supporters went to Washington on January 6th and violence broke out at the Capitol. And they tell you that the protesters wanted to take over the Capitol and take over the government. It was a coup, is what they tell you about January 6th, an unsuccessful coup. And I ask you to imagine that it was a successful coup. And you're in Texas, you're in Arizona, you're in Ohio, wherever, and you're watching this go on in your Capitol, this coup d'etat take place, and you're watching all these people who are not from your country, like John McCain and Christopher Murphy and Lindsey Graham and Amy Klobuchar. You're watching all these people from another country, from far off in your capital, cheering on these people that are staging this coup. You're watching the coup break into violence after the sniper incident on February 20th. You watch all that take place, Then you watch the Yanukovych government have to flee because of the coup. You may have voted for Yanukovych. You may be a Yanukovych supporter down here in Odessa, down here in Crimea, in the Donetsk region, and you're watching this go on, and you're not happy about it. You don't agree with what's going on, and you watch this go on 10 years earlier. I think that's really significant that you go from 2004 to 2014 to now we're in 2024. 10 years. So from the Orange Revolution to the 2004 coup, from the 2004 coup to today. So you watched all of this go on in 2004 as well, and you're watching it go on again in 2014. And the people in these regions, the people in Crimea, the people in Odessa, the people in the Donbass region after the coup d'etat, first of all, you got to understand when we put the Nazis in power, the Nazi government that we put in power, we put the Nazi government in power. There should be no doubt about that. And we'll get more into this in the next podcast. But we know that we were in charge of the new government that went into power. And we'll talk about who those people were in the next podcast. But we have the Victoria Nuland phone call. Something really interesting about Victoria Nuland. This is Victoria Nuland's Wikipedia page. Victoria Nuland is a neocon. Victoria Nuland's husband, look at who Victoria Nuland's husband is. Robert Kagan, neoconservative scholar. He is a critic of U.S. foreign policy and leading advocate of liberal interventionism. He a co-founder of the neoconservative project for the new American century. This guy was the co-founder of the project for the new American century. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. So this is Victoria Nuland's husband, and Victoria Nuland worked for the Bush administration as an ambassador to NATO for George Bush. So this chick's a neocon. What is she doing? What is this neocon doing working in the Barack Hussein Obama State Department and the Joe Biden State Department? This neocon. I mean, aren't these guys supposed to be liberals? Isn't Joe Biden supposed to be a liberal? Isn't Barack Obama supposed to be a liberal? Why would these guys have this neocon running foreign policy for them? But this neocon was in a phone conversation with the then ambassador to Ukraine, and their phone conversation was leaked, and they're talking about who they're going to put in the government, that the Barack Obama State Department had full control over the new government that was going in. Listen.
When you're a high-ranking official talking about diplomatic efforts in Ukraine, the last thing you want to do is drop your guard.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
But that is exactly what reportedly happened between US Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and US Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt. The exchange has since surfaced online, including the crude swipe at the European Union. The audio clip of a woman and man, said to be Nuland and Pyatt, hears them discussing strategies to work with the three main opposition figures.
I don't think Cleet should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
In terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking, in terms of...
So we understand that the Barack Obama State Department, with this neocon running the whole show, is saying who is going in the new government. The Barack Obama administration said who can go in the new government. They were putting the new government together. We're going to talk about in the next podcast who this new government consisted of.
Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. The exchange has since surfaced online, including the crude swipe at the European Union. the audio clip of a woman and man said to be Newland and Pyatt. Here's them discussing strategies to work with the three main opposition figures.
I don't think Cleat should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
In terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking, in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tony Book and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych is calculating on all of this.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tony Book on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
So she's saying that she wants Yatsenyuk to be the new leader in the interim government. And guess who becomes the new prime minister? Guess who becomes the new prime minister? Arseniy Yatsenyuk. So we're going to talk about how Arseniy Yatsenyuk and who he is and how he became prime minister after Victoria Nuland from the Obama administration gave him the nod. But what I want you to understand is how all of this going on in Kyiv, this coup d'etat being ran by the United States, how it's being perceived down here in Odessa, how it's being perceived by the people in Crimea, how this going on is being perceived by the people here in Donbass. I have a little bit more time. I want to play a little bit of this clip. CNN, and this is a protest in Odessa after the coup d'etat. I want you to look at a little bit of this, and then we'll get back into this in the next podcast.
These are the masked pro-Russian gangs now threatening to splinter what's left of Ukraine. Not far from Crimea, hundreds gathered in the southern port city of Odessa, demanding unity with Moscow. Ukrainian riot police, loyal to Kiev, look on as the banners of the old Soviet Union fly high. One protester, who gave his name as Artun, told me he was furious with the revolution in Kiev and wanted Russia to take control, just like in Crimea. We're all standing here for Russia, he told me through the slit in his balaclava. None of us wants to be part of the European Union. Across swathes of Ukraine's Russian-speaking south and east, the aftermath of the country's violent political change has left many feeling the same.
Well, that's the helmet, severely damaged, you can see, from a Ukrainian police officer. It's interesting, this memorial here in the southern city of Odessa, because it's almost like a mirror image of the scenes that we've been witnessing in the capital, Kiev, because these aren't memorials to the protesters. They're memorials to the Berkut, the special police, who were implicated in the shooting of so many people in Kiev. But of course, many of them were killed as well. Lots of photographs here of the scenes from those protests that led to the overthrow of the president, Viktor Yanukovych.
So what you're seeing here is what he was saying. He was saying the exact opposite of what was going on in Kiev was going on in Odessa. People were rallying around the ousted government, and they wanted have a connection with Russia. They identified more with Russia than with the EU, and they did not support the coup. They did not support what was going on in Kiev. All of these people, tons of people who voted for Yanukovych. You want to talk about democracy and do you support democracy? Yanukovych was democratically elected fair and square, and he was overthrown by the United States government in a coup. It's not democracy. You're not supporting a democracy if you are supporting what happened, what Obama did in 2014. And what about these people? Again, think about January 6th and what, I mean, who's going to fight for these people in Odessa? Who's going to fight for the people in Crimea that felt the same way and in the Donbass? We'll talk about that in the next episode. And we didn't really get to the question of Russia invade Crimea. We got to the beginning of it, but when we start on Friday, we'll get right into that question and talk about what happened in Crimea after the coup. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll see you guys on Friday.